And this is now talking with Rolf Dice at Arecibo on 23rd September, 77. This is to replace an interview that was lost in the luggage back in March, 77. Okay, can you tell me just a little bit about your educational background and how you got involved with radio?
Well, it was in the summer after I graduated from physics at Cornell. I was looking for a...
Which year is this now?
This is now 1951. I was looking for a... I wanted to go to graduate school, but it accepted in the EE school at Cornell, which is a switch across the campus and a different bunch of faces and so on. And I was looking around for a research topic to get started in.
Mm-hmm.
And there were sort of two main well-funded programs going on at Cornell at that time. One was tubes, turned out. Failures. Why do tubes fail?
I see.
This was the hot topic at that time. They were discovering, for example, that instead of the airplane companies yanking all the tubes out of their radios at the end of the month and putting all new ones in, it was better to leave a tube in that had not failed and simply back up the equipment. Because once a tube was in the socket about 100 hours, it's a high probability it's good for 10,000 hours. Well, that was a major discovery, saving millions of dollars for people. All right. But I found that a little dull.
Yeah.
But Ken Bowles at that time was just getting started too, and he was bouncing amateur radio signals from the Northern Lights at the 6-meter band, 50 megacycles, and the 2-meter band, 144 megacycles. Amateurs were then just uncovering the fact that they could get from A to B that way.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't know much about it. The signals were very chopped up, of course, because of the broadening in the spectrum that was occurring, because of the rapid formation and deformation, it turned out, of the scatters.
All right.
And so they had to use hand-keyed telegraphy, and later on they found that single sideband worked.
Did he have a research program on this, or was
this? Oh yeah, what he was trying to do was, okay, what's the fading rate of the echoes coming back? Let's get started. You know, he went that way. So he would get on the air at night when Aurora was on, which was usually in the evening, and he would call up, talk to a radio amateur via the Aurora, and he would say, hold your key down for a minute, I'm going to record you.
I see.
And he would record this, and then he'd do spectrum analysis of the autocorrelation. Try to get the power spectrum out of what he saw. Unfortunately, he did not preserve the Doppler. He was simply taking the AM output of the receiver
right at
first. There was a lot of things he was missing by not having the
sign
preserved of the Doppler shift. And he would record this on high-speed film, and he would hand-read all these numbers, and he would punch them up on IBM cards, and he used a gang punch up at the egg school to do his multiplications and horrible things like that, which started Ken Bowles on his career as a dedicated binary digital man.
I see.
He's now, as you know, head of Computer Center at UCSD.
Oh, I didn't know that.
That was the aspect he liked. I liked the aspect of communications, the angles, where this stuff was physically coming from. And so I got involved in monitoring a station, which turned out to be in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, which was transmitting via, it was doing E-region scatter at 50 megacycles, getting a reliable signal into Washington, D.C. by pumping enough power at the E-region. But the side loads from that transmitter were good enough for me to bounce over all of the northern sector and get echoes from the Aurora. And I was studying this angular spectrum of arrival and that good stuff.
So it was really a geophysical investigation that
it was really
you were doing.
Yeah. I don't call that astronomy yet.
Right. And is that what your PhD was about?
That slowly folded me into it, you see. And then I ended up going up to Alaska for a couple of summers, which is a beautiful way to do, incidentally. Anytime you can, try to get away from the campus when you work on your thesis topic. And there was one system for me. We'd go up there in the summer when the weather was delightful and work like bandits. We all hard, very hard all summer and come back all refreshed for the winter quarter. It was really great. Anyway,
let me ask you, did you know at all about Charles Burroughs and the radio astronomy that was going on in Cornell at that time?
Oh, yeah, sure. Well, I was alongside of them. At that time, it was mainly watching the sun. They had an interferometer, 200 megacycles.
Was Seeger there still?
He
may have been a few years before.
He left, but I saw him later pass through there. He stayed for a brief time. Mm-hmm. Charles Burroughs was the head of the department at the time I was there.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And...
Who else was involved in the radio astronomy?
Well, Mike Colbert was involved.
Colbert?
I saw a lot of Mike Colbert, who's still at NAIC at Ithaca now. He was involved in the solar observation, not so much as a scientist, but as a doer, getting the thing to work.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw a lot of him because my equipment was out at his site.
How do you spell that name?
C-O-L-B-E-R-T.
Okay. And is Beryl still alive, do you know?
I think not. Don't know.
And anyone else in this group?
Well, I was working under Henry Booker.
No, I mean in the radio astronomy. The
Well, Bill Gordon was involved in radio astronomy in a little bit there. He was more interested in scatter, but he was involved in the research programs going on there, more of, as an administrator, I think, at that time. Actually, that was a pretty dead program, frankly.
Yeah.
They got going, and they had some other things which they did, but it was a frightfully dull program, and it was a good thing it was finally shut off.
Yeah, it wasn't one of the leading ones at that time by any means. But how did this bibliography thing come out of that? I guess Martha Starr Carpenter was in it from the beginning. You know, that always came out of Cornell through the 50s and early 60s. Do you know how that originated? I'm just curious. It's a very valuable resource for me, as you might imagine.
I see.
Okay, so you got your thesis then in auroral research.
Right.
What year?
The construction, and I did several things. Like up in Alaska, I ended up building. We gradually switched over to radar techniques, where we would send our own pulses out and scan them back. And partly because you get the antenna pattern squared. And I think one of the best things that one of the nicest things, which actually took only about 6 weeks to do, was I took a radar up north of the auroral zone. And then I tried to see where I could see aurora from up there, and I discovered I could still see it to the north, even though that was not where the most frequent aurora was. It was occurring all over the sky into the south, and I couldn't get an echo from it. And this helped tie it down the fact that, boy, is that stuff field aligned. So it has to be within a few degrees.
I see.
Down at Ithaca, the aurora occurs in the north, and that's where we're perpendicular to the field. So we would see the stuff maybe 700 kilometers to our north.
Right.
And at Fairbanks, it'll be down in the north also, it'll be overhead to some extent, but we always thought there was something mysterious about the northern edge of the auroral zone. So we went up north of the auroral zone and looked in all essence, and it was still to our north and so on. Yeah.
So you got your degree then what year?
55.
And then was this when you took that tour of...
Well, then, the Air Force had been wanting me all along, and I've been postponing them year by year and just sort of trying to wind up the thesis before they got me. And I went and worked for Rome Air Development Center.
Rome Air Development Center, right? Rome Air Force Base,
that's right. And at that time, they were busy designing the BMUSE, the Ballistic Missile Early Warning System. Now, that was fascinating, you see, because that was lots and lots of power. And
right.
Was going up to Thule, Greenland initially, and then to Clear, Alaska, and then to England. And really got in on the ground floor in the planning of that, in trying to get them to move to higher frequencies.
Mm-hmm.
And I sort of won and I sort of lost. I got them to move as high as 400 megacycles. Sure enough, when they put the thing on the air, they saw auroral echoes. But they were able to they were able to code up their computer to decide that it was aurora and ignore.
Right. And, of course, there's a famous story about lunar echoes also.
Lunar echoes there, too, yeah.
Was that something very shortly after I got on the air and just no one had thought about getting lunar echoes, or what is the story?
I think I wasn't really deeply involved in it. I wasn't really there when it happened, but it was a complete surprise.
Yeah.
It didn't need to be.
Okay, so how long did you work on that at Rome?
Now, let's see. That was only 2 years I was in the Air Force, and I had, as contractors, Gordon Little up at the University of Alaska.
I see.
Who was a radio astronomer.
Right. Right.
And he was busy inventing the rheometer, for example. But he had agreed to do for us was build an interferometer capable of looking at certain point sources in the sky and looking for the angular jitter as it passed down through the aurora.
Mm-hmm.
He was interested in understanding the passage through the aurora, and we were interested in it from a practical point of view of, okay, what's this going to do to our radar
right.
when you try to look through the aurora? And so he built for us two 28-foot dishes, for the Air Force now, two 28-foot dishes on polar mounts, which I gather are still up there.
Hmm.
I don't know, 100-meter baseline or something like that, east-west.
So this is really auroral scintillation as opposed to ionospheric.
Yeah, right.
And was this published, this sort of, never heard of this sort of research. Was that published in JGR or something?
Yeah, but I can't put my finger on anything.
I guess it probably didn't help. By that time, the nature of the scintillation as being due to the atmosphere was clear. So it really was not astronomy in any sense. You didn't learn anything about the source.
I don't think so, no.
Or,
no, it was aimed at, well, the Air Force's point of view was this is a practical application and we've got something we want you to go out and measure.
Right.
So he went off and did it. But of course, that was a useful machine that I guess they used for other things up there. But yeah. it wasn't designed specifically to do some basic research, and so I thought it, and in a way his hands were a bit tight.
Yeah. So after you got out of the Air Force, then what was the next step?
Well, at the same time, we were concerning ourselves with moon echoes, too. We were concerned about the echoing behavior of the moon and let's see now.
For possible communications use, or?
At that time, the Navy was using it for communications to Hawaii.
Yeah, I've talked to Trexler, actually, about that.
That's right. No, I think that's
the... But what was the Air Force's interest?
Well, we were interested in all kinds of clutter. I was interested in meteor echoes as a source of clutter, which would be seen on these radars. And we sponsored Alan Peterson and Ray Liederbrand, neither of whom are astronomers, but we're interested in the ionosphere and in VHF phenomena in general. And they built
Stanford
Research Institute,
right.
Although Alan was joint appointment. And they built for us a couple of 60-foot dishes, El Cheapo. They were really shoestring, marvelous machines. And initially the plan was to put them both at Stanford and do wavelength studies. What was the dependence of wavelength on these meteor trail echoes and what about them? And other things, like sporadic E. Like, there was one case there at Stanford where we saw sporadic E bounced back from the ground and that kind of thing. Not astronomy, still. But then they found that this thing got nice moon echoes, and so they went off and did some moon echo studies that I told you about in the last tape.
Well, we're going to have to repeat it here.
Yeah.
Now, what year are we talking about now?
Well, it's sort of 1950 now. Let's see, 50. I went out there in 57. And so it was right away we got involved in that kind of thing. 57, 58, about in there, a little before I arrived, a little after I arrived. We had one of these radars set up 60 megacycles, 60-foot diameter dish, fully steerable, 100 megacycle frequency, 106 I think it was, 106.1 megacycles in the FM bandwidth. It actually was an used FM transmitter that we'd rewired for pulse. And we could see meteors on this thing fine, and we could see the moon fine, and we did things like, what is the fading rate of the signals coming back from the moon? We were kind of interested in that sort of thing. What is the echo strength? What happens as you change the pulse width and the strength of the echo that comes back?
So you're really just using the moon as a reflector, once again, for primarily geophysical research.
We were looking at Faraday rotation through the ionosphere.
Right, yeah. But you really weren't trying to figure out anything about the moon's surface at this stage.
We were trying to figure out how large the patch was that was giving the echo on the moon.
Oh, yes, okay.
Looking at the spectrum of the Doppler shift. You know, anything that we could do with this machine.
Okay, so that's what I want to get at, though. So you were concerned about what the moon was doing to the signal also.
That's right. So we one of the experiments we did was a separated station experiment. And we had a bus that I showed you those pictures with this Yagi array of antennas that would fit on the back. And then we'd move this bus to different places, different distances away from the main radar. And we'd transmit from the 60-foot dish, and we'd receive at the 60-foot dish and the bus at the same time. And then we'd examine the correlation that occurred there. Things turned out about the way we'd expect. There's a patch on the moon. It's pretty shiny. It's not the width of the moon by any means. And it would result in decorrelation occurring a kilometer or two on the Earth's surface by the time I got back. Think of the moon illuminated as a complicated antenna with the wild phase relationships on it. What would be the beam width of those little structures as they swept across the Earth? That kind of thing.
And it was the order of a kilometer or few.
Right.
Had anyone done any sort of this bistatic radar before off the moon, do you know?
Well, let's see, the...
people had received at the same site.
Right, well, of course, the moon... there was lots of interest in bistatic things, because the moon presented a possible
communication. Oh, for the communications, I'm sorry, of course.
Well, communications and also listening to signals from other places.
Like Russia,
Such as Russia, for example, right. In fact, I one time went down here, we were looking at the moon... We could see great long 2-millisecond pulses on there. And it turned out these were the BMIAS radars scattered from the side lobes, presumably.
Yeah.
Jeez. When you turn this antenna on the moon, you see all sorts of wonderful signals.
Yeah.
Now we pay no attention to that here.
But, of course, this was 20 years ago with nothing like the Arecibo beam.
Gosh, I guess it is, yeah.
So this group, then I get the picture, is this right, that it was primarily interested in geophysical phenomenon, but it would figure out some things about the moon that it could get, and and you published your results in JGR.
JGR was our chief of it at that time.
Primarily. Mm-hmm. Were you talking to astronomers at all at that time?
Well, we had lunch with them in the sense that the Stanford, Bracewell at Stanford, mm-hmm. was active in his astronomy, mainly looking at the sun.
Mm-hmm. And maybe Swarup was there at that time?
Swarup was there at that time, too. I don't think there was any other extra solar system astronomy going on there, was there?
If you had to call yourself something at that time, what would it have been? A radio physicist?
Yeah, right. We use that word a lot. I don't know what that means, but it is.
Uh-huh. Certainly not a radio astronomer.
Not a radio astronomer by any means. Yeah. No one ever claimed that. No. All during my career, I've been involved in things which utilize radar mainly.
Mm-hmm.
Back at Cornell, when I was doing my thesis, we were cooking together oddball sort of radar-like equipment in the sense that you transmit a man-made signal up and it would be a very long pulse or something and it would come back and you wouldn't hardly look at it and call it a radar. But with that, you can do several things. You can look at the aurora, you can look at meteors, you can look at the effect on the ionosphere as you pass out, you can look at the moon. Then we got involved in the nuclear testing program. They were going to set off these high altitude explosions in 1958, and so we participated in the effects. There's always a bunch of hangers-on that look for the effects of these things, and it's a good thing somebody does because they got some big effects.